From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're devoting this holiday weekend show to an American tradition of unsurpassed symbolic and emotional resonance, one that showcases the best and arguably the worst in the life of the nation. Sports. They break racial barriers while enforcing racial stereotypes. They venerate the power of the human spirit while displaying the sovereignty of accumulated cash. They extol the virtue of perfect bodies while participating in their devastation.
I've always had, going back to the 90s, problems with the fundamental viciousness of the game.
NBC's Bob Costas is speaking of football on the Hang Up and Listen podcast.
And it isn't just the contact and the violence. There's a bloodlust. Is it true of everyone in the game? Of course not. But it's true enough of a large enough strain within the game that reasonable people ought to be concerned about it. And too much of the media doesn't just gloss it over. They'd rather just get on to the next thing and glorify it and run the commercial.
Back in 2011, former Chicago Bears defensive back Dave Duerson committed suicide by shooting himself in the chest to preserve his brain for study. He was posthumously diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a brain disease that has been linked to many sports, especially football. Currently, a class action suit by more than 4,000 football players against the National Football League is in the process of being settled. The players claim that the league covered up a link between football and brain damage. The pressure is on the NFL to better protect its players. I talked with the NFL's chief marketing officer last year when the NFL was defending itself in part by running public service announcements during games. This one features Patriots quarterback Tom Brady and now retired Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hey.
My little boy loves playing football.
It's a great game.
But what is the NFL doing to make the game safer?
We're doing a lot. Carl?
Well, Tom, we're developing new rules to better protect our players.
And over the next decade with the NFL Players Union, they're dedicating more than $100 million for medical research.
Wow.
As well as supporting the development of better and safer equipment.
And I feel a lot better about him playing.
Love to meet the little guy.
Ray, meet Tom.
Cute kid.
When I spoke to Mark Waller last year, I asked him about the Ray Lewis and Tom Brady PSA, which struck me as oddly whimsical.
It's a tone that really works for getting people's attention, and they listen. So it's a very effective style that actually has people very focused on the messaging.
I myself have, over the decades, spent, the women in my life would say, squandered thousands and thousands of hours watching NFL games. It is appointment TV for me. I am a big fan of my team, the Philadelphia Eagles, disappointing though they may be. But I am truly a conflicted man. It's so dangerous now, and the collisions are so violent. I worry that they are gladiators, and then I feel guilt for being an enabler.
That's a very natural human reaction, which is why we, I think, are taking the steps to make sure that people are clearly and transparently aware of it. The athletes that you watch now on TV, those athletes started off as young children and they were taught and educated to play the game in a specific way. And I think as human physicality has evolved, so we need to do more to evolve how the game is taught, how it's played, and ultimately what rules it's played under.
In no way am I suggesting that there's a parallel between the NFL and the tobacco industry. But the body language of the campaign, and not just the body language, but actually the explicit language, so reminds me of the approach the tobacco industry took when it was trying to distract all of the world from the insidiousness of their business.
It's a flawed comparison because you're comparing the latter phases of the tobacco industry with the start of ours. Our body language is nothing like when those guys stood up in Congress. We've taken this issue on transparently, publicly, and full on, working really hard on the research side to understand more about the issues and ultimately give all parents, all children, all athletes the right information and as much information as possible for them to be able to make an educated decision about whether they should play the game or whether they should watch the game.
Have you gotten any pushback from traditionalists who think that the rules protecting the quarterback and prohibiting chop blocks and spearing and all of the other safety-oriented rules changes make them think less of the game, that, you know, they wish it was just men in the trenches doing what men do and that sort of mentality.
Less about that focus. There is concern from fans that if the game changes radically, it won't be the game that they love. They want the game to continue being as exciting as it is.
Considering the trajectory, what we're learning about head injuries and the rules changes, is radical change in the NFL's future?
I think radical change is in everybody's future. It would almost be an anachronism to be anchored in the past while the world changes around you.
Well, just protect Vic. That's all I care about. Because he has no offensive line.
He needs to protect himself.
Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, Bob.
Mark Waller is the chief marketing officer for the National Football League.
Coming up, behind the scenes with the people who tell the story of the game.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In early 2010, the Wall Street Journal did some investigative football game watching and came up with a shocking revelation. Having sat in front of four NFL games with stopwatches in their hands and having broken down every second of the broadcasts to determine what viewers actually see during a three-hour-plus game, the Journal concluded that after the cheerleader shots and the announcer in the booth shots and the crowd panning shots, viewers see a grand total of 11 minutes of football. 11 minutes. For fans, the study simply confirmed that TV football is much more than a recording of a game. Instead, the mere game is a point of departure for an entire narrative, a story told with interviews and narration and a vast variety of shots. After the Journal study came out, I spoke with Bob Fishman, a legendary game director for CBS Sports. He told me that the story kind of missed the point.
I would love it to be 11 minutes. I'd show up, have a cup of coffee, do 11 minutes, and go home and get paid for it. But it takes a tremendous amount of preparation, and then obviously during the telecast, what goes on in the TV truck is something that the viewers don't get to see, but that's a show in itself.
You are in a tractor trailer parked underneath or outside the stadium. There are, a lot of monitors arrayed in front of you. What are you doing during the course of a game?
My job, basically, is to decide what you, the viewers, see at home. And we have an array of cameras, we have an array of angles, and it's constant nonstop calling of shots and telling my camera crew what I want on every particular play.
So what would it sound like, just if we could isolate your voice from everything else that was going on in the truck, what would we hear coming out of your mouth during a part of a game where, you know, there's actual plays in progress?
Well, let's take the opening kickoff, for example. I might say something like, camera one, return man, standby camera two, camera three, give me the far side coach, camera six, I want you to give me the near side coach. Now the ball is kicked. Take two. Run back happens, and I might say three, close up, linebacker, take three. Four, give me a defensive coordinator, take four. Camera two, get back to so-and-so. And it's a constant flow of information that I'm giving to my camera crew.
I don't know how many cameras you have on various angles of the kickoff, but after the play is over, let's just say the return man took the ball 5 yards deep in the end zone, ignored his teammate who was trying to tell him to keep it in the end zone for the touchback, and ran out and got only to the 12. Are you telling any cameraman to make sure he follows the guy to the bench to see if the special teams coach chews him out?
Reactions is a big part of what we do, because as a director, and I'm only speaking for myself, I think the emotional part of the game is kind of interesting. You know, we have a thing in our business called, you know, goats and heroes. There's a guy who's doing well on a play, and there's always a guy who's screwing up on a play. And those reactions we weave in and out of a broadcast. So in the case of what you just proposed, a guy is supposed to kneel down his teammate, and you clearly see the teammate saying, stay there, and he runs out. I need a reaction of the coach, of the special teams coach, whatever, and the player going to the sideline.
In those briefings that coaches give network crews in the days before the game, they apparently sometimes say, we're going to run such and such a specific play to this receiver or this back because we have seen such and such a weakness in the films. I got to ask you if in, let's say, the Steelers-Ravens game, if the Saturday before the game, the Ravens ever try to, you know, take you out for drinks to find out what the Steelers told you in the pregame briefing.
Never happened. If we know a certain player is not going to play, he's listed as questionable, and we are told he's really, like, out of the game, and sometimes that we will be told that, mm-hmm. We would never share that information with the other team. If they don't say it's off the record, it's on the record. But as far as giving team information and injury information, and we're going to run a flea flicker on the first play, that is absolutely never shared with anybody, and nobody's asking to go out and have drinks with us.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you.
Bob Fishman is a game director for CBS Sports.
It's a gain of 13 here at the back end of the quarter. And just a quick mention, John, that completion by Tom Brady was his 4,000th of his career. He did 8 passes complete tonight coming in. And another mark for Tom.
Well, if you were following the Patriots' scoring drive against Carolina on Monday Night Football, that was a useful tidbit. But there's ESPN announcer Mike Tirico calling the action on the field, which is about 2.5 tons of high-speed hubbub, and he's keeping track of the game stats in progress, too? No, the stat was put in front of his face on a little piece of paper, like a clandestine note in 7th grade social studies. Except the passer alonger wasn't a tween gossip, it was a very circumspect senior citizen with bad handwriting and white hair, Marty Aronoff, elder statesman of broadcast statisticians. For the past 30 years full-time and 8 part-time years before that, Aronoff has been scribbling statistical nuggets for broadcast announcers on all major networks and plenty of minor ones. Even at the age of 75, he's traveling 200 days a year to do it.
Tomorrow, I fly from Washington, my home, to Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm doing football Saturday, Michigan State at Nebraska. Sunday morning, I will fly back to Washington. I have a college basketball game that evening, Oregon State at Maryland. Monday morning, I will be flying to Charlotte, North Carolina for Monday night ESPN NFL appearance with Mike Tirico and John Gruden. The game is New England at Carolina. And then I will be home Tuesday, and those are the next 4 days.
And on Wednesday, he rested. You do this 200 days a year. When you show up in the booth as the statistician, what exactly do you do?
I sit right next to the play-by-play announcer, and I supply them information that I observe as the game goes on, trends that are developing. It may be a historical note. It may be something about an individual's recent performance and how he's doing that particular night. I listen very carefully to everything that's being said by the announcers. I'm there to supplement what they're doing. I have to be concise, accurate, and timely, very timely. I can't let something happen 3 plays ago and now suddenly I'm showing them something.
Many a young man has lay awake at night imagining being on the pitcher's mound for the New York Yankees or being the quarterback for the Chicago Bears. I'm sure many have done voiceovers of games imagining themselves to be the broadcasters who sit in the booth and bring the game to the viewers and listeners at home, my guess is that there's been hardly a little boy or girl who has lay awake at night dreaming of feeding stats. Did you, as a kid, harbor that fantasy of someday telling a play-by-play man how many blown saves Mariano Rivera had recorded to date?
Never. I got an undergraduate degree in mathematics at Penn State and an MBA at Northwestern, and I worked for the federal government here in Washington for 17 years. I started doing this as a sideline well into my professional career with the government. It just happened by accident that I had the opportunity to help a friend of mine, Warner Wolf, who got the play-by-play assignment with the then Washington Bullets in 1975. And I was doing a lot of traveling. And I said, Warner, if I'm ever in a city where you're doing a game, why don't I stop by and just help you out, give you some numbers? And he said, great, let's try it. But I never, when I was growing up, thought of this. It was really fate that put me into this. And by the time I started doing this full time, you know, I was into my 40s.
We are living in the golden age of sports statistics. The digital revolution and fantasy sports have created a huge demand and the tools for meeting the demand. Now, you've spent the lion's share of your career having little at your beck and call than the fact books that the leagues and the teams provided. Now you have access to just all of this extraordinary detail, almost absurd detail. Do you find that it helps, or are you like, you know, the former Soviet emigres in a supermarket who are overwhelmed by the choice?
Well, you're absolutely right. I have so much information available to me. A lot of what I have to do is be very selective. There are people who do what I do, especially younger people, who want to make themselves known by the volume of notes they give to the announcer. So they throw things at him or her, and not all of them are really that relevant. They're more just to show that the statistician is on the ball and he's got a lot of information. But I'm very selective. I pick my spots.
And finally, was there one moment in all of the thousands of games that you've done stats for that made you want to just jump up and give yourself a high five because you had just the thing for just the moment that people would remember beyond the play itself?
People remember Bill Mazeroski in 1960 for the Pirates.
It is all over in one of the most dramatic finishes on history. Bill Mazeroski has hit his second World Series home run over the left field barrier 406 feet away, and the Pirates are the 1960 World Champions of Baseball.
Joe Carter in 1993, and of course, Bobby Thompson.
Bobby Thompson.
One out, last of the night, back of pitches. Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. Back of throws. There's a long strike. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant.
I remember 2003 American League Champions Series between the Yankees and the Red Sox, and I had just given the announcer, as we go into the 11th inning in the tie game, this could be an opportunity for another historic moment. And Aaron Boone comes up, and Boone hits the home run, wins the game, and the announcer gives me a big thumbs up because he just said that.
Marty, thanks again.
Thank you, Val. It's a pleasure.
Marty Aronoff is a freelance sports statistician for a number of famous name broadcast networks.
By three, as Boone hits it to deep left. That might send the Yankees to the World Series.
Sports beat reporters travel with the team they're covering, flying city to city and writing about every game. The proximity between journalist and player offers great access, but it can also impair journalistic judgment, like the White House press corps turning a blind eye to JFK's womanizing. Sports writers have been known to leave unreported a star athlete's less heroic moments. Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Frank Fitzpatrick covered the colorful but erratic Phillies outfielder Lenny Dykstra in the 1990s. Dykstra is in jail for an ever-growing list of theft, drug, and fraud charges. In the midst of the jurisprudence about 2 years ago, Fitzpatrick told me he regrets what may have been too much journalistic indulgence in covering the star.
You know, when I think about Lenny, I think he embodies both versions of the word dirtball. In a good sense, he was a baseball dirtball, which meant he hustled and he dug and he tried to beat you in any way that he could. But in the negative sense of that word, he was rude and crude and astonishingly boorish. He would have been a great character for a novelist, let alone a baseball beat writer.
And Dykstra kind of chose you as much as you chose him as a subject. How so?
He was a great journalism junkie. He knew who every sports writer in every town was, who could write, who couldn't write, who might help him. And he identified me pretty quickly as a guy who could help him. And I, you know, being a new baseball beat writer, was sort of enamored that the star of the team had taken to me in a sort of warm, if Lenny could ever be considered warm, sort of way. When he would totally ignore questions from people from lesser publications or other people that he didn't know, you know, he would always make time for me. And he knew what I wanted. I mean, he could be funny and, you know, he could be irascible and he could be the dude, which, you know, it was a character he sort of created for himself.
That's what he called everybody, right? He could never remember anybody's name, so he called everybody dude, and it came to be called the dude himself, right?
That's right. And the dude became sort of a caricature of who Lenny Dykstra was. I mean, this was a train wreck waiting to happen, and we knew this back then, and you know, you can't help but looking back thinking, you know, why didn't I do a little more in portraying this side of Dykstra instead of, you know, going out of my way to portray the other, the more appealing to me side of him.
When you would spend time with him, the stories that came out of it would reveal some of what you witnessed, but not all of what you witnessed. What kind of stuff did you choose not to share with your readers?
Did we all suspect that he was doing steroids? Yes. Did we all suspect that he was taking greenies, you know, the amphetamines that were omnipresent in baseball clubhouse in those days? Yes. Did we know he cheated on his wife on the road? Yes. Did we know he was astonishingly rude to fans and media members that he didn't know and who he didn't want to have anything to do with? We knew all these things, and yet behind everything a baseball beat writer does, there's this fear of severing a good relationship, because without them in a competitive news environment, you're dead. So I think we're probably all guilty of hiding the true character of Lenny Dykstra for all those years.
The notion of a gentleman's agreement is not novel to journalism. White House reporters in the 60s, for example, were widely aware of President John F. Kennedy's sexual transgressions, but chose not to report them, I guess, on the grounds of what they deemed then to be irrelevance. But the gentleman's agreement about political peccadilloes has more or less dissolved over the decades. Does it still exist in professional sports writing?
I think it probably does to some extent, but on the other hand, the sports environment has changed so much. These players and these teams are so much more savvy now about hiding people from the media, about training players how to deal with the media. I know when I interview athletes now, it's shocking to get anything out of the ordinary from them. They're so cautious and so careful. They have so much to lose. So whether that gentleman's agreement exists or not is difficult to say, because there isn't that same kind of closeness, that intimacy almost that we had with these guys. I mean, we were living with these guys for 6-7 months a year, and you know, they didn't have as many places to hide as they do now.
The thrust of your column was that you harbor a sense of culpability, that you, in so cherishing this intimacy with Lenny Dykstra, became an enabler. If this were 1993, and you could do it all over again, the Phillies were on their way to the World Series, and Dykstra was a candidate for the Most Valuable Player Award, and you had written candidly about all of his excesses, what would have happened?
There would have been very few players that would have talked to me. You know, the manager would have been even more difficult to deal with. You would have been able to do your job, but only in the most routine, uninteresting fashion imaginable. In terms of inside information, you would have been lost.
Okay, so this is now 2011. This is an age when Brett Favre essentially puts his genitals up on eBay and it shows up everywhere. There seems to be no shyness about reporting the most crude, the most vulgar, the most licentious of behavior. Do you think that it's actually had an effect on the players? Does this change in journalistic culture actually force them to suppress their, let's say, basest tendencies?
No, I don't, but I do think they're more cautious about it. If you're using drugs, you've got drug tests. If you're going to a nightclub, you've got 100 people there with cell phones who know who you are. So this is a strange new world we live in, and I wouldn't want to be a player or a beat writer in it, to be honest with you.
All right, Fitz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob. It was fun.
Frank Fitzpatrick is a columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer.
So sports has its bad guy stories, which can be problematic for the media, and its good guy stories, which sports writers love. But every once in a while, a story comes along for which there is no established narrative, because the story is so much bigger than even the biggest sport. Jackie Robinson of the Brooklyn Dodgers broke Major League Baseball's color barrier 66 years ago. His story is the stuff of legend, as in the film named for his number, 42.
You want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?
No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back.
Robinson's legend took shape and took off from the very start.
You give me a uniform. You give me a number on my back. I'll give you the guts.
Just 3 years after his debut as a player, he starred as himself in the Jackie Robinson story.
Suppose I collide with you at second base, and when I get up, I say, you dirty black so-and-so. What do you do?
Mr. Rickey, do you want a ball player who's afraid to fight back?
I want a ball player with guts enough not to fight back.
Throughout the more than six-decade celebration over Robinson's achievement, the chief interpreter of it, the strong and steady hand behind both the man and the myth, is virtually unknown. Los Angeles Times sports writer Bill Plaschke has tried to draw a portrait of this largely invisible man.
When he was 17 years old, he played in a really important baseball game, and a scout came, and he was the pitcher, and there was a white catcher, and a scout came and said, you know, I'd like to sign you to play for professional baseball, but you're black, I can't do it. So he signed the white catcher instead. From that moment on, Wendell Smith said that he was going to try to break the racial barriers in baseball, however way he could do it, and he couldn't do it by playing, so he decided to do it by writing. So he was a sports writer who was also an advocate. So it was Wendell Smith who first came to Branch Rickey, the Dodgers general manager, and said, hey, I got a guy you should look at to be the first black in baseball, and that's Jackie Robinson. Branch Rickey decided that Jackie would be the best candidate to break the barrier. One of the first people he called was Wendell Smith, and he said, listen, we want you to travel with him. So they traveled together for the first 2 years of Jackie's pro career. It would be unthinkable today for a newspaper to allow a writer to accompany just one player all the time and take care of him.
He ghost wrote Robinson's weekly newspaper column.
Yeah, he was his voice. He would also counsel Robinson on how to deal with the media. And okay, they're going to ask you this, you need to say this.
You wrote that when Robinson resisted, Smith would remind him that he himself was enduring the same racial slights, only without the stardom.
That was to me, the most compelling part of the movie, which mirrored real life exactly from my research, was where Wendell picked up Jack at the train station, and Jack's like, Wendell, I get tired of you. You're always with me. You're always trying to counsel me. You have no idea what I'm going through. And Wendell stopped the car and looked at him and said, Jack, why do you think I sit in the stands at games? Why do you think I type my stories with a typewriter on my knees in the bleachers? Why don't you think I'm in the press box? Because I'm not allowed in the press box. Because I go through the same stuff you do. Open your eyes. Can't imagine as a sports writer not having access to a place to write your story. I can't imagine that. He had to cover the team a whole year before the Baseball Association of America even let, you know, Wendell join.
In The Courier, the black paper for which Wendell was still writing even as he was traveling with Robinson, he encouraged black fans to conduct themselves well at games, and he downplayed the ugly impact of racial incidents in baseball.
That's what he counseled Robinson, and that's how he wrote. He wrote it like, you know what, we're supposed to be here, we belong here, let's act like we belong here, and let's act like anything that happens to us, we can handle it.
Describe what he looked like.
Wendell had, you know, big glasses, and, you know, he was a slightly built man and just kind of blended in. He wasn't loud and he wasn't abrasive. And it was interesting. I'm describing him mostly from the one photo I've seen of him and from what his wife has told me, because nobody really knew what Wendell looked or sounded like because they didn't take pictures of sports writers back then.
He did later become an on-air sports broadcaster for WGN, right?
15, 20 years later, yes, he became an on-air person. By then, he was a very huge figure in the African-American community and as far as in the media. He also, in Chicago, Wendell Smith also wrote a series of columns that they thought should have won a Pulitzer Prize about how, despite baseball being integrated by the early 60s, spring training was still segregated. Players could play on the teams, but in the spring training in Florida, they had to live in separate hotels, in terrible hotels. So he did a huge series about that, changed baseball. Baseball stopped going to those spring training sites in Florida that would not let blacks and whites live in the same place.
Even though they didn't hang out after Jackie's brilliant career, they still remained tied.
The last story Wendell Smith wrote, he was suffering from cancer, and the last story he wrote was from his hospital bed. He wrote Jackie's obit. And then a month later, Wendell died as well.
Why do you think Wendell gets written out of the story time and time again?
Frankly, I must admit to you, until recently, I didn't no idea of this man's great impact. The producers of the movie told me they didn't know until they studied it. We thought it was Jack against the world and Jackie and Rachel against the world. And we just certainly would not imagine him to be a sports writer.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bill Plaschke covers sports for the Los Angeles Times. Yay! Coming up, a conversation with Clyde.
This is On the Media.
In the street, Jackie Robinson hit that ball. It went zooming across the left field wall. Yeah,
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield, just letting you know that this segment first ran in March. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Okay, Bob warned me that this next interview might be too New York and maybe not so media, but it is with a man who spent his life navigating the media, who proved you can have second acts if you want them. His first act brought down the house, or at least Madison Square Garden, in 1970. I wasn't a sports fan, but his speed, his cool, his name was in the ether. Walt Clyde Frazier, New York Knick.
Frazier cuts to his left, now stops and jumps. Yes! Frazier out of the backcourt. And one looking very west across the midcourt, unlooses to Frazier.
With his mutton chops and his fedora, he rolled on fancy wheels through New York City, an icon of laconic cool. In that historic 1970 championship game, Knicks team captain Willis Reed, playing with a terrible injury, was the hero. But Frazier's lethal steals and stealthy buckets clinched the win.
Willis provided the inspiration. And, you know, in a way, I provided the devastation.
Frazier's little rhyme there foreshadows his second act, the one you may not know if you don't live in New York. He's a Knicks color commentator on the MSG network, famous for his truly astonishing suits, coordinated ties and pocket squares, and for his vocabulary, his rhymes. That's what got me.
Marlin and Apollo, splendor on the glass.
Erratic, dramatic, charismatic, acrobatic, SJR.
Penetrates, creates, rising on peculiar, and the left hand, ain't that peculiar?
I'm still not a sports fan, but drawn into the hoopla over then-Knicks prodigy Jeremy Lin, I found the legend of my youth, now voluble and amiable, but still cool. I read about his childhood in segregated Atlanta, changing the diapers of his many sisters, playing on dirt courts, his passion for yoga, his retreat in St. Croix, his restaurant, Clyde Frazier's Wine and Dine. How did he manage it without combusting like so many superstars, without even a surgical repair? We invited him to WNYC's Jerome L. Green space and asked NPR sports reporter Mike Pesca to kick it off with his own meeting with the man.
The year was 1994, and I had just seen a game at Madison Square Garden, got outside, bought a pretzel on the street, and was walking away. My friend and I turned around, and there was Walter Clyde Frazier. And so I kind of smeared the mustard off my face, and I put the pretzel in my other hand. I felt that I rebounded, and then I proceeded to astound by extending my hand and saying, "Clyde, it is a pleasure to be meeting and greeting you." And he said, "Nah, nah, nah, meeting and eating." And I turned to my friend like a giddy schoolgirl, and we just said, Clyde, rhyme to us! Clyde, rhyme to us! And now, at 5'3", hailing from Park Slope, Brooklyn, the host of On the Media, author of The Influencing Machine,
go, New York, go, New York, go.
Brooke Gladstone! And at 6'4", basketball Hall of Famer, commentator for the MSG Network, he played his college ball at Southern Illinois. He's a 7-time NBA All-Star, 2-time NBA champion, Walt Clyde Frazier!
Ladies and gentlemen, Walt Frazier!
I started off by asking Walt about the genesis of his nickname, Clyde.
When I was a rookie, I wasn't playing well. So in order to pacify myself, I went shopping. So I dress up in my room and go in the mirror. Well, I'm not playing good, but I still look good. So one day we were in Baltimore. It was a hat store, and I see this Bossalina hat, brown velour, but it had a wide brim. And like today, everybody was wearing a narrow brim. So the first time I wore this hat, everybody laughed at me, my teammates, the opposition. 2 weeks later, the movie Bonnie and Clyde comes out. So I walk in the locker room, everybody go, hey, look at Clyde. So that shows you kids that if you have something you believe in, don't listen to nobody else.
A former teammate said that the legend of Clyde, your legend, was partly a media creation, but that you happily went along with it.
Yeah, that's true. Clyde is an alter ego of mine, which operated between 12 and 4 a.m. So the rest of the time, I'm Walt, nice guy from Atlanta, Georgia, that changed diapers and do all that stuff.
You know, Harvey Arriton, in his brilliant book, When the Garden Was Eden, said that you put on Clyde the way that Leonard Nimoy puts on his Spock ears, that it's comfortable if alien, or maybe it's comfortable because it's alien. Did it help you deal with the scrutiny?
Normally, I'm home alone. I never had an entourage. And, you know, when I was Clyde, I had a driver.
And that was quite a car.
Yeah, the Rolls Royce. But normally, I'm a very quiet and shy person. People laugh when I say that, but I'm a shy guy that likes to walk around in mink coats and Rolls Royce.
Well, let me ask you about the style in your game. You, more than anyone, monumentalize the steal. Stealing on the court, as you describe it, demands cool, playing possum. It's like poker at 100 miles an hour.
I'm playing possum. I'm lulling you to sleep. I give you room so you think that you can do something. So sometimes early in the game, I could steal the ball, but it wouldn't have the same impact. So now you're dribbling the same way, and all of a sudden I come and I make the steal. It could turn the momentum of the game, and then
you're describing a pool hustle.
It's a cat and mouse game that I played on defense. But defense was my favorite part of the game, primarily because when I was in college, one year I was ineligible to play because of poor grades. So as a punishment, the coach made me play defense every day in practice for a whole year. I'd never played offense. So I said, well, if I'm going to be a defensive player, I'm going to be the best damn defensive player of the year.
We were talking in the green room about the earliest rules of the game. You said the game was very, very boring when it started. And why was that?
Because, you know, they started on a peach basket, but it had the bottom in it. So every time you scored, they had to get on a ladder and go and take the ball out of the peach basket. So it took them 7 years to figure out to take the bottom from underneath the basket.
But it seems like the game in recent years has changed a lot, too. I was watching the Knicks game last night, and it seems to be built very much around star shooters. It wasn't team play like the Knicks of the 1970s.
Well, that's true. That's one of the more blatant changes in the game. Shooting a lot of threes and dunks and nothing inside of the arc. To me, the most glaring difference in the game today, other than the money, is the size of the players. Like when I played, I was a big guard at 6'4", Today I'd be a shrimp. I'm a point guard today because the average height of an NBA player is 6'7".
Do you wish that the three-pointer had never been invented? I mean, do you find it dispiriting that everybody focuses on taking these really long shots?
Well, it's a blessing and a curse. But today the game is entertainment. Today is who's in the stands, the celebrities, and that type of thing. So it's more focused on getting the young kids to buy the video games and the merchandising, the jerseys, and ESPN. We never had ESPN. So these guys know today if you do something, a good dunk, you're going to be number one or number two on ESPN. The only time you're going to see a good defensive play is if you block a shot to win a game. Other than that, it's all embellishing offense.
Do you find it boring?
No, I've accepted it. When I first started, I was like, oh, these guys can't play. I was like, nobody can shoot. What are they doing? Today, a guy would rather make a stupendous dunk shot and go 0-for-10. Just the way the game has evolved.
The three-point shot, it's cinematic. You say it's changed because of TV, but has it actually changed the rules of the game?
Oh, yeah. They took away the hand check. Why? Because they wanted more continuity. They wanted more ball movement. Nobody liked the game. People were complaining the game is too rough. There's no movement. There's not enough shooting. So television pays the cost to be the boss. I think other than that, the rules have been better. Like when we played, the shot clock was on the floor. And I attributed a lot of my steals to guys trying to find that shot clock. Last second shot, and they're trying to look for that clock, and then I'd have the ball and go on the other way. But today, both shot clocks are above the basket, so it's much easier. You don't have to try to look for it. So I like a lot of the changes, making the game more popular. It's an international sport now. When you look at basketball, when I played in the 70s, everybody was from the U.S., Today, a third of the players are from all over the world. It's like tennis. So it's a very popular game. I mean, look at Dennis Rodman. He's becoming a political. He's going to bring peace to the world.
Diplomat. Yeah. The 70s, New York in the 70s, America in the 70s. This was an incredibly racially charged time. Did it get to you?
Well, I actually came along at the right time. Guys like Oscar Robertson, Bill Russell, those were the guys that really kind of paved the way. So when I came into the NBA, black players, we never had to stay in separate hotels like Russell and those guys had to do. So, you know, I really pay homage to them for making those sacrifices. And then having guys like Bob Cousy and Hondo Havlicek, the white players also supporting the effort to integrate basketball. Basketball has come a tremendous way now. When you look at maybe it's 80-20 black now compared to 60-40 white when I came into the league. And I'm from the South, so I still believe that if not for sports, the South would be segregated.
Really?
Yeah. It really propelled them to look at people differently. They wanted to win, and they knew the black players were dominating the game, and they started integrating the schools, and that made it happen. But as far as when black and white meet, there's no color, it's just respect. And when you were playing, and that's why guys accept each other more in sports than any other venue, because of the respect of talent when guys compete.
You once said, I was never afraid of being an individual, even if it meant I was going to be ostracized for it. Well, that's never going to happen, but the wide lapels, the wild colors, not the austere style of the third millennium we're currently in. You couldn't care less, right?
I think when you're a visionary, you can't be concerned with what people think.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to just walk up and down Fifth Avenue, look at how women were dressed, how men were dressed, and my tailor was only a few blocks from there. So I see different color combinations, and I run to my tailor, and I have things made up. And a lot of times I talk to kids, and I say, don't be afraid to veer from the path and leave your own footprints. You know, I think today when I go in our schools, everybody walk alike, they all talk alike, they all look alike. There's no individuality. You know, everybody's a follower. There are not too many leaders. So we've got to get back to not being afraid to do what you want to do. But the other part of my always being cognizant of dressing for success was growing up under the oppression of segregation. And being the oldest of nine kids, so whenever I went downtown, I was not only representing my family, my neighborhood, but my race as well. So my mom was always telling me, Walt, you got to set a good example for the kids. So whenever I went out, I was aware of that. And even today, I'm still aware of that, especially when I got into broadcasting. So many of you know I wasn't using, they say, $100 words when I was a Nick player. But once I got into broadcasting, I didn't want to embarrass myself, my family, or my friends. So right away, I knew, I said, man, I have to improve my vocabulary.
So how did you do that? Bounding and astounding, creating, penetrating, erotic, acrobatic, certainly charismatic, but where did it come from?
I started on radio. So the guy that I was working with, he never gave me a chance to talk. And radio...
on the radio, that's a definite disability.
So sometimes I start talking and I couldn't shut up. He'd go, excuse me, Walt. He just run right over me. So then I was getting bored and I just came up with, like, if the Knicks would make him passes and I knew he had to catch his breath, and I go, they're dishing and swishing. You know? That was about all I could get in. You know, they're ubiquitous. They're provocative. So to improve my vocabulary, I used to get the Sunday Times, the arts and leisure section when they critique the plays.
Oh, the plays.
Yeah, riveting, mesmerizing, provocative, profound. So people think I'm a voracious reader, but I have books and books of words and phrases. When I first started, I just studied these books over and over. And ironically, you can use cliches and no one will ever say anything. But if you use ubiquitous twice, they'll go, he used that word twice already. And then all of a sudden, I fell in love with words. Words are like people. The more you see them, the more you relate to them. And even today, like just like fashion, I'm always looking for new words and how I can incorporate them into my style.
We took audience questions, and one woman asked about how pro athletes make the transition from the limelight.
That is a daunting task that I would say 80% of professional players never make. Their marriages dissolve. Drugs and alcohol problems. Many of the players I played with or against are destitute now. Sometimes the players are so bad the teams have to bury them when they die. Sports Illustrated did an article, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago about 80% of the guys, once they leave the game, professional players, 7 or 8 years after they leave the game, they're broke. And I think the best thing that happened to me was getting traded. Leaving New York.
Going to Cleveland?
Going to Cleveland. I was all dressed up and no place to go. I used to get dressed up and go out and wear my meat. Guys go, Clyde, where are you going? So I became a homebody. I was reading a lot of self-help books, you know, because I knew I only wanted to play a couple of more years. So I was reading books that would help me make that transition into not playing. And it still took me a couple of years to get over that. So you can imagine today how players, we should fly commercially. We stayed in Holiday Inns. Today, these guys are in the Ritz-Carlton's, the Four Seasons. They have their own private plane. They're making millions of dollars. So how do you come down from that? How do you make that transition from that after you squandered your money?
How many players do you think, like you, never received a technical violation? Never mouthed off at a ref, never got tossed out of the game.
Maybe 1%. I give kudos to my coaches for that. In grade school, high school, college, they never allowed the teams that I was on to talk back to the refs. We never had prima donnas. Everybody had the same rules, you know, in
college.
But you
also didn't like the fines.
Phil Jackson asked me once, Clyde, how could you pay $50 for a pair of alligator shoes? You know, back in that day, the alligator shoes cost $50. And I go, how can you pay $25 for a technical?
Okay. This was just part of a much longer conversation. To see Clyde's dazzling suit, my pathetic attempt at free throws, and the evolution of his inimitable style, watch the video of the event on our blog at onthemedia.org. You'll hear about how he helps kids conquer fear, why his plants don't die, and the cabinet post he would have held in Bill Bradley's White House.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.